Hello there, and welcome to Preprints in Motion, a podcast taking a deep dive in the fast-paced world of preprints.
Join us as we sit down with early career researchers, discuss their latest preprint, and find out about their journey through the muddy marshes of academia.
Hit that subscribe button, leave a rating, and find us on Twitter at MotionPod. Support us by heading over to buymeacoffee.com/preprints. But for now, let's get into the show.
And this week we have Michelle from Research Square returning for another episode, this time to talk about preprint retractions. So, recurring guest, which means we must have done something right the first time we had you on. You were also the first guest, actually, which is great, because last month was our 1 year birthday. So we've come full circle.
Happy birthday.
And we're talking about stuff that, again, we were kind of recently talking about with other people, which is preprint retractions, versions of record, which we should probably define. I think it's in my question list, but it might be near the end of my question list. So I guess we should start with a little bit of an overview over what your paper was on that you recently published.
Sure. So this was a project that I took on during a sabbatical leave, which is a one-month sabbatical at my company that comes around your 10-year anniversary. And you're meant to, you know, do some project that's going to contribute to the company in some way that you don't necessarily have time for in your day-to-day, but something you're interested in and will give some useful output. And what I decided to look at is something that had kind of been weighing on me already, which is what happens to a preprint when a downstream publication associated with it gets retracted. And as I've now mentioned a couple of times, I've done at least one other podcast about this, and I wrote a Scholar Leakage and article about it, so it's my first time sort of talking casually about it. But I already sort of knew the answer because I was discovering these retractions very ad hoc, usually through the Retraction Watch newsletter or through Twitter. And that's just because I tend to be very familiar with the types of papers that are getting a lot of attention on our preprint platform. And then when I see the author names pop up again in the future or the title of the paper pop up again, I recognize it. And that happened a couple of times. And it was just sort of, you know, if this is happening by happenstance, then surely it's happening on some level below the detection level. And so there must be a systematic way of looking at this. And that's what I decided to focus on for that month that I had off. And I did this for our preprint platform, Research Square, of course, and for BioArchive and MedArchive. And the main reason I stuck with those servers is just that they have some commonalities. They tend to be, I mean, BioArchive and MedArchive is all biology and medicine, right? Of course. And Research Square is largely life science and clinical research as well. So there's an enrichment for that type of research. And also because I happen to know that both our server and those servers have automated mechanisms for linking publications, journal publications, to our preprints. And we try to do this somewhat reliably.
Sorry to interrupt, but do you do the same? So BioArchive do that by linking the titles. Is that how you do it as well?
So we do it using three different mechanisms. BioArchive also does it technically using two, because they allow authors to come back and update them, which they don't do typically, at least not for us. And from what I've heard Richard Sever say, it doesn't happen that often for them either. So they have to use Crossref, and that relies on a fuzzy matching of title and author lists to create that connection. We have a third mechanism, and that's by virtue of our connection to Springer Nature journals. So essentially everything that's in many of the preprints that are in our server are originating as journal submissions. And so they have a different unique identifier associated with them that means that even if the title and the author's lists change, that's a persistent identifier that we can follow. So if it makes it all the way through to acceptance and publication, we can get an update and then update the paper that way. And if we don't get it that way, then it'll hopefully be updated by Crossref. And so they kind of fill the gaps for each other. So that's how we do it. And we know that BioArchive and MedArchive do a pretty good job of this as well. And so we knew that these are the servers that are just about as comprehensive as you can get when it comes to linking downstream publications. So it's a good place to start to look at what happens after that point. And not surprisingly, I didn't find that many retracted papers. So what I did was I looked at all of the versions of record, meaning all of the journal articles that were associated with the preprints, and tried to match them up against the DOIs that are issued by Retraction Watch for every retraction or even different kinds of events, like various corrections or errata that they might have on their database. By the way, it's the biggest database for retractions that's out there. It's over 32,000. I don't know where they are right now, but the time I did my analysis, it was 32,000 entries on that database.
Sounds like a lot.
It's a huge amount, but it's not a huge amount of the literature. That's like, I've done this calculation now in different ways, but I think it comes out to about 0.06% of all papers that have been published, which is 50 million or something like that of all time. So, but it's a great database and it's more comprehensive than, say, Crossref, which has, you know, closer to 10,000 entries. So when we match this against the list of VORs, I got 30 retractions. So across those three servers, there were 30 papers that had been retracted that were associated with preprints on those servers. And of those, only 11 had some kind of notation on the preprint to indicate that there was a retraction downstream. And of those, only 5 of the 11 were themselves withdrawn by the preprint server. So that's like a whole separate question of whether that should happen or not. We can talk about that, but
we will.
Yeah.
Although that was largely what you wrote about.
Yeah.
So, I mean, good selling point for the company, giving you a little sabbatical. It's a very nice one. So why were you interested in looking at retractions? Why does it matter?
The main reason is just because we, like anything else related to a preprint, we want to bring in context. So that's kind of my this desperate need for context around preprints, right? We know that we post preprints without much assessment. There is a brief screening, and then they go up online, and we kind of leave it up to people, leave it up to the scientific community to decide and hopefully provide their assessments on those preprints. And that doesn't happen all that often, as we know. It doesn't happen as often as we'd like it to. But to the extent that we have some information, some kind of context that's related to that study, we want it to be, visible from the preprint itself. So that context may just be that it was published in a journal, and we can argue as to how valuable that is to know that and which journal. But then it's an incredibly important data point to know that that journal later on decided, for whatever reason, and what were those reasons, to retract the paper. That almost always will reflect on the preprint, because as you know, Johnny, the preprint doesn't change very much. Nope. The basic conclusions of a journal article are not generally very different from the preprint itself. So whatever is relevant to the journal article, we can assume is going to be relevant to the preprint. And this is it's dangerous not to have that information. It's very concerning not to have that information on there, because some people will only ever see the preprint. You know, depending on what search mechanism they're using or, you know, what their process is, they may land on the preprint without fully understanding that it's been published in a journal and that it was later retracted, and they might cite it. And this, you know, just further inflates the problem of citations of retracted, that there already is a problem with citations, persistent citations of retracted papers. And this kind of is another route by which people can do that, which we don't want to facilitate.
Yeah. And this did prompt a discussion, which we see, it's one of those things that seems to cycle around Twitter every now and then, which is, should we remove preprints if their paper has been retracted? Or should we leave them up with a notice on? Should we not see anything?
Yeah.
So what do you think we should do with those? And what does Research Square do with those?
So I think they have to be taken on a case-by-case basis. And in this paper, I specifically broke things down by, you know, what the reason was for the retraction. Was it a form of misconduct, whether it's like research misconduct or publication misconduct, if you want to call it that, plagiarism and piracy and things like that. And then secondarily, whether the reason for the retraction calls into question the validity of the study necessarily, because it doesn't necessarily have to, right? Retractions are done, some huge proportion of the retractions on the Retraction Watch database are because of journal errors. So, and sometimes it can be not misconduct, but an error that the author caught and had to alert the journal of it. And in those cases, you know, it may not be misconduct, but it still calls into question the validity of the conclusions of the paper.
And we only have a question, we only catch them after we press submit. We never catch things before.
Always. Yeah. I caught a few things with this paper. then I'm going to have to, you know, correct. Yeah, exactly. So, so we have to make some kind of effort to, you know, to call attention to those retractions, but not just that, to give some consideration for why it was. And then think about whether, if we only knew this information about the preprint, would we withdraw it as a result? That's kind of the way that I think about it. So I don't think it shouldn't be necessarily an automatic thing. It was retracted and therefore we withdraw the preprint. So far, I've considered these all on a case-by-case basis for the 17 or so that were relevant to our platform. And in all of the cases, it just so happens the validity of the conclusions was called into question. And so I did think it was ultimately reasonable to withdraw them. But I can imagine a scenario where that wouldn't be the case and where I would choose not to. I also leave an editorial note, so that this is one thing that's come out of this, is that we have some sort of actionable plan for how to deal with these retractions going forward. Because one is, we weren't doing this in any kind of systematic way. Like I said, I was just discovering them, just sort of tripping over them in my day-to-day work. And the other thing is what to do once we know about them. And so we have a kind of a new protocol for this now, coming out of my sabbatical, where we will we'll have an automated mechanism for actually tracking these things down. By the way, BioArchive and MedArchive did a better job than us, have done a better job of noting retractions, like a higher proportion of retractions were noted on their preprints than on ours, which, you know, sorry to admit that, but it's true. and I asked Richard about that, and, you know, he said that they're using Crossref to match them up. I don't know exactly what the mechanism is, but we're going to end up doing the same thing and just looking for updates to the metadata that should be noted when there is a retraction. Big asterisk on should.
Yes.
And then, you know, deciding from there what to do about it, whether it's just to leave an editorial note, to leave an editorial note and withdraw the preprint.
I think that you keep saying withdraw, which is an important distinction I was taught when I was chatting with John and Richard, because preprint servers don't retract things. It's still up there, it's just withdrawn, and it, you know, you can still read it, but it's clear that you shouldn't be using it, you shouldn't be citing it for whatever reason that may be. And it's a really important distinction between papers or journals and preprint servers.
Well, I would say that withdrawal and retraction are actually pretty good analogs of each other from preprint to journal, because journals are also not supposed to expunge the record of a paper when they retract it, right? That's would be against COPE guidelines. And there are cases where that needs to happen, where the information is really dangerous or has some other serious ethical issue with it. But generally, the paper is supposed to stay up findable so that it can be referenced. I think this is a really important point, and it's something that has worked to our advantage at times when people need to look back on a preprint that has been withdrawn and then later was published in a paper, in a journal, which is something that happens. And that's another, great, analysis that hopefully I'll be able to do one day. It's not just to look at the ones that we have withdrawn for various potentially ethical reasons or misconduct that later got published, like how often does that happen, but also the ones that we reject. And we do have, they are recorded in on our back end, so we can see them. So theoretically, we have a way of following up and seeing how often do these papers that are rejected because they're just so obviously egregiously bad, and then they get later published in a journal.
That would be a risky analysis to do. You'd get a lot of backlash from certain publishers and people I won't name.
Certainly would.
Yep. I mean, we didn't even do anything particularly outrageous. But that would be a very, that was one of the things I really wanted to ask, because it would be a super interesting question. Because of course a lot of people, you know, everyone I think is very aware that no matter what you do in science, you can publish it anywhere. There's a home for everything these days. There are even, I think it was in the, again, with Richard and John, where there's a preprint server for all the crap that just should never come out.
Is it Vixra?
That's the one, yeah. You know, so you can get it anywhere. So it'd be really interesting to see and track. I wonder if that tracks with this. So I think you found roughly a similar percentage of the preprints were withdrawn to what you find in the normal published literature.
Actually, slightly fewer. Yeah. And no matter which estimate you use, like you take, you know, the total number of retractions over the total number of publications, like I mentioned before, I think that gives you around 0.06%. And if you use another estimate that I think Ivan Aransky himself mentioned in a Science magazine article, editorial, that was around 0.04%. And if you look across all of these, it's 0.03%. But honestly, it's such a small data set, I would be reluctant to draw any conclusions from that. I think it'll be very interesting to look at it down the line and look at it more holistically and to include Archive, for example, which is a massive preprint database repository and other preprint servers as well that have huge volumes of preprints. I mean, I think it'll be a very interesting question to follow up on in 5 to 10 years.
So one of the other things you found was that preprints were removed slightly quicker than non-preprinted retracted articles. Is that because the preprints have been up longer and more people have read them? Or is that some artifact of just the fact that maybe it was during a period of time where that particular field was under a lot of intense scrutiny for whatever reason? Why was that?
I've thought about this a lot and I don't know the answer, but I wouldn't even say it was slightly quicker. For this set, it averaged around 9 months, whereas the broader average for Retraction Watch, even in that same time period, so I kind of limited it to just after 2014, because these things change over time, that was 23 months.
Okay.
And the really broad average is like 33 months. So we know like that time is, and there's been some studies on this, like the time from publication to retraction is shortening. And why that is, I can only speculate. I may have more to do with the fact that all the papers in my set were open access, and OA articles naturally are going to get more post-publication reflection just by virtue of being more accessible. I mean, one of the studies on this topic that I reference in the paper makes a specific point about the higher retraction rates at high-impact journals. So it turns out the more attention a paper gets, the more likely there is that a serious problem is going to be caught. But, you know, again, I didn't want to read too much into this result because the data set is so small. So maybe there's something else going on with it. But it was certainly worth pointing out because it's such a dramatic difference. And I think it would be really worthwhile for someone out there to look at time to retraction among open access articles compared to non. Yeah, I mean, I think what we will find is that they are retracted much more quickly, which is a good thing, right? It doesn't necessarily say anything about the quality of the paper. It just means that there's a lot more papers that should be retracted in the paid access set.
Yeah. So what do you think your findings say about the quality of preprints? Because this is something I seem to get into arguments with people all the time about.
I think they say nothing about the quality of preprints. And if anything was going to say something about it, and even this is problematic, it would be the proportion of preprints that are ultimately published, and which is different across different servers for reasons we could get into. But I think that's dangerous to even speculate about that. There are certainly people now who issue a preprint without any intention of publishing it in a journal. This is going to become increasingly, and maybe this is a privileged position to be in to decide that you're going to do this. But I think we're going to see, you know, increasingly people using that action. We actually had, I think I might have tweeted about this, but it really gave me a chuckle. We followed up with a bunch of people who had submitted preprints to us directly, not through our integration with Springer Nature journals. and for whom, you know, 18 months, I think it was 18 months was the cutoff. If 18 months had elapsed and we still didn't have an automated link to a journal article, we asked them, you know, have you published it? It would be good to, again, to establish that link. And a bunch of them got back to us and gave us the DOI to the journal article, which is great. And one person said, well, that depends what you mean by the word published. Yep. The version 4 is up on the preprint server for all to see and scrutinize and give feedback on, and what more is needed. So I was like, oh, touche.
So that's very reminiscent of the conversation we had with Stefano Vianello. Mm. He wrote a bit about prefigurative politics and applying that to publishing. So I guess this is a good point to talk about version of record. What not everyone listening will necessarily be familiar with what version of record is, because it's not something as a scientist you really think about all that often. To be honest, you just think paper, done. So what is version of record, and why is a preprint not necessarily the version of record?
I don't know that I have the correct definition for the version of record. I've always reserved that characterization to the version that is peer-reviewed and published in the journal, that is endorsed by the journal, effectively. But I think strictly it should mean it's the latest version of the article. You know, like that, to me, the version of record is the most updated version of the preprint if it's only ever appeared in preprint form. Because presumably, you know, if they've issued new versions, it's come as a result of having received feedback from the scientific community, which is peer review, and have, you know, made the appropriate changes to the article to reflect that feedback. And that is the version that people should cite when they cite the study and should refer to. So that's how I think of version of record. But, you know, I mentioned in the actually, I don't know if I mentioned it in the PLOS paper, but I mentioned it on the Scholarly Kitchen write-up that we are going to move from version of record to record of versions over time. Like, I think this is going to be the norm. Mm-hmm. And it's much more reflective of the scientific process to do that. Because now we know, of course, that things change even past the point of publication. You really have to get away from this mindset that once a paper is published, that it's somehow done and dusted. Yeah. And that's, you know, part of the call to action here is on this paper is to call more attention to that, you know, that it's not over once it's published.
I would love to see a lab just build their entire lab on the principle that they say they publish a paper and that's their version. But then they go back to it and they update it with the next postdoc or students, like carrying on continuation of that work. And instead of having all these papers out, they've just got this one long document. And that is their lab's output. That I'd love to see that. I don't think anyone would be brave enough to do that, but I'd love to see it.
Maybe Arcadia will be brave enough to do that.
I mean, they're trying some really cool stuff. And it kind of sounds like it would be along those lines, actually. The trick is, can they get it to work back the other way with having people work for them and then get jobs in academia based on that? I think that's where the challenge will be.
Right.
Or the big challenge will be. But then I think it sounds like such a lovely place to work. I don't think anyone's going to ever want to leave.
Agree.
So you mentioned, you know, flipping this around and looking at things the other way. So papers, and had they had a preprint retracted. Do you have any feel for what kind of numbers you would expect? Do you think it would be a similar sort of proportion as what you found with preprints to papers that are retracted? Or do you think you'd have less?
As opposed to preprints that are
preprints that are retracted to, yeah. Yeah, that's a really bad question.
No, I mean, I'm curious if you're asking about preprints withdrawn.
Yeah, I got my words wrong the first time.
That's why you have to stick to that terminology, because it can get very... I just reviewed a paper where they were using withdrawn and retracted interchangeably, and it was actually a very similar study to mine. And I got so confused. I couldn't understand what they were saying half the time. And that's why it is important, because also journals use the word withdrawn for some things that are not considered retractions. They're like temporarily withdrawn to check some things or make some changes. Anyway, that's a great question. Right now, I can think of only one case where we have withdrawn a preprint that was published and that had been published in a journal, And it was because of a misconduct problems. Actually, one of these ivermectin, one that came down in the great fall of ivermectin. Yeah. And this is one that, you know, Gideon Meyerowitz Katz wrote about, and there were a couple of blog articles that we pointed to extremely thorough dissections of these papers and really kind of incontrovertible evidence of misconduct. It was undeniable from my perspective, and I put a pretty detailed editorial note on the preprint that also mentioned that the journal has been alerted to these problems by the same whistleblowers that came to me. And as yet, we have yet to see any action on the part of the journal. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that really speaks to the quality of a journal, in my opinion. I'm extremely suspicious of journals that don't retract papers. And there is some subset, there's quite a large subset that have never posted a retraction. And that should really make one raise their eyebrow. But now to see it sort of firsthand in a case that just so obvious and so egregious, and nothing happening on the journal end. So that's...
Why do you think journals don't? Because you can assess the cases as they come in. So if somebody says, I read a preprint on your platform, I think there's these problems with it, you can read that and then you can make a judgment whether that's right or not.
Right.
I presumably you've got people you can talk to as well, who are experts and could comment on that too. So why is it journals are not, in many cases, not removing problematic papers, but also taking so long to remove problematic papers?
Part of this to me is sort of the stigma of retraction that's been with us for a really long time. And it's the same reason why I think authors are probably often reluctant to come forward about problems that they, you know, they see with their own papers or they've caught with their own papers, because it's easier to just let it lie and move on and not draw any attention to yourself. But, you know, the sooner we start applauding people and applauding journals for these really pro-social behaviors, the better things will get. And this just, it runs counter to intuition, because, you know, admitting fault is hard. Admitting you've done something wrong or you've made a mistake, you just assume is going to reflect poorly on you and hurt your career. And it really just should be the opposite, because all of us make mistakes, and journals included, right? Editors will have limited capacity to be able to catch everything, reviewers same. And it's a lot to ask of 2 to 3 reviewers to uncover every, you know, possible issue. Not only that, but rarely is data reviewed, and a lot of the problems end up being found in the underlying data if somebody can get their hands on it or really starts to look more deeply than the average reviewer will look. So these things, I'm sure there's a, you know, many times more papers that should be retracted that aren't. And we really need to start getting comfortable with the retraction numbers going up. That shouldn't be a sign that something has gone terribly wrong with science. That's the sign that something is starting to go right.
Yeah. Science, of course, it's meant to be self-correcting, right? And self-correcting is removing mistakes.
That's
or at least
right.
Identifying mistakes.
I don't know if you saw this. It was a few months back that someone went on Twitter and talked about her retraction that she initiated. And, you know, there was, I mean, this went totally viral, this tweet, but so I didn't see every response on it, but certainly the vast majority of comments and quote retweets were positive, including my own. Just let's normalize this and make people not only feel comfortable coming forward when there are problems, but feel like they're going to be, you know, embraced for it and sort of rewarded for it even. Because again, like this stuff happens all the time. I mean, just remember how many mistakes I caught along the way, you know, in my own research. So easy to make little errors that have, you know, big consequences. And I just think this is a cultural change that I think is starting to happen. I think it's a really positive sign that we've seen such a big uptick in retractions, which was, you know, a point that I made at the very beginning of the paper. We're seeing both preprints and retractions are going up at the same time.
Yeah.
So again, creating the links between the two is just going to become more and more important. And again, it's like an important data point for preprints. So yeah, I think it's a really positive change and we should keep cheering it along.
I wonder if that's because preprints normalize versioning and updating your work.
Yeah, it could be.
Whereas obviously with a paper, you can't do that. So if there's a mistake, you'd rather maybe not draw attention to it.
Yeah, the fact that it puts a nail on the coffin, so to speak, really makes people, I think, really hesitant to do anything about it. And that's the one of the many problems with this binary of, you know, published, not published.
Yes.
That we've kind of been entrenched in.
So what would you have done if you'd had longer to work on this? Is there anything you really, really wanted to look at?
I would have included more servers for sure. I think including archive would have been really interesting. I would have, you know, and that would have necessarily increased the scope of the analysis to include other fields, which would just be interesting in and of itself, right? And what's happening with physics or what's happening with the social sciences. They all of these have their own different cultures of publication. Some have, you know, with physics and math have embraced preprints for a really long time. And does that change sort of has that changed how they deal with those kind of downstream events? That would have been an interesting thing to look at. And definitely the time to publication. As soon as I saw that number, I knew that there was something else to look at there. And actually I posted this paper just because it seemed really appropriate to do so on a preprint server first on MetaArchive, and got a preprint review from somebody at Crossref. And that was really cool. It was not, it was one of these things where I had to make the PLOS editors aware that this has already been reviewed by someone, and they'd already given me some feedback and that I have incorporated those changes into the version that I submitted to the journal. But he was just really interested in this question of open access and how much it contributes to the rate of retraction and the turnaround time on retraction. I think this Crossref is in a good position to look more deeply into this. Retraction Watch didn't have a field for open access versus not open access. It was only 30, so I was able to look at them all individually. Yeah. But to do like a large scale analysis without having a discrete field for that would be really difficult. Crossref does have that information apparently, so it would be easier to do that analysis using Crossref. So I would have done that as well.
Yeah, I think that's one of my favorite findings. It's just the fact that having it open access seems to lead to things being identified and action taken earlier, which is kind of the point, really.
Exactly.
So if I don't know who else listens to this, but you know, if somebody from a different preprint server is listening to this, what are their main takeaways that maybe they should start thinking about introducing and how they run things?
So the number one is linking to those downstream publications. I think from what I can tell on ASAP Bio's sort of repository of preprint characteristics, the vast majority of servers don't have automated mechanisms for this. It's actually hard to tell because they'll say, yeah, you know, is there a link to a downstream, to a journal article? Yes. That's not, it's not clear if that means that there's a way for, you know, to do it. Like if an author comes back and indicates that the paper has been published, can they indicate it on the platform? Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably most platforms do allow for this, but we know that authors typically don't do that. They won't. They certainly won't if they're not approached about it. So we can't rely on authors to do that. So we must use the mechanisms that, you know, like Crossref, the matching mechanisms that we have, which are totally imperfect. This is the frustrating thing, is that like bits of data fall away at every step of the way. Most preprint platforms don't have the mechanism. Those that do have the mechanism are missing some non-trivial amount of data. I don't know how much it is. Like it's just an unknown. How much do we not know about? So that's number one. I hate to put any of the, and I wrote the paper very carefully so as not to, certainly not to call out anybody, but I also just hate putting the onus on preprint servers, which are totally under-resourced, and they do what they do for free for the betterment of science. And I think we probably should just be sharing more with one another in terms of if we have code for creating these automated mechanisms, then sharing it across servers would be really good and would be to everyone's benefit. to that, you know, that I'm saying that just as much to my own company as to everyone else. But more I definitely called out journals here a lot, where even the journals that are very supportive of preprints, you know, that allow preprints and encourage the deposition of preprints, none of them link to preprints backward, right? So now I think eLife is the only one that's doing that consistently. And that it's obvious why they would do that, given their recent, you know, shifts. Now everything starts its life as a preprint at eLife. But the other journals, for the most part, don't ever mention a preprint. And I doubt that it's even, I know that the PLOS journals ask at the point of upload whether there is a preprint associated with that paper.
I don't think they do anything with that information, though. They didn't for ours.
No, they didn't for ours, for mine either, I don't believe. So there isn't like a fixed field that shows, you know, here's a previous version of this paper. And there really ought to be. I mean, so a few people have referred to the paper as a call to action. I think that's a fair characterization, but maybe not for the exact reasons that other people seem to think it for. It's not about the technical aspects, the existence of the links, the inclusion of the information, the metadata, the mechanisms to tie these things together. Those are all really important. But I want the focus to be on getting serious about preprints as a scholarly output, right? Because we're not there yet, not even close. It's now, this is the first point of exposure for the scientific community and the rest of the world on more than 8% of studies. I don't know what the most recent number of this on. This is the most recent I've seen. Yeah, so 8%, at least that was the case in 2020. And that proportion is just going to continue to tick up over time. So this is the version that gets augmented, that gets revised, that gets pulled apart at various stages. And so as much information as possible should make it back to this version. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, preprints will be relegated to this sort of static early draft that doesn't matter past the point of journal publication, right? Like it only matters for a brief period as a means to give the author, you know, a way to share the research earlier than they could otherwise. But doesn't turn out to be the place where the assessment happens, and it's not the place where the feedback and other outcomes accumulate. And that's not the future that most of us, you know, that are working hard in this space want. That's not that where most of us are cheering on this evolution, want to see a different future, a preprint first future for all scientific outputs. So in order to move in that direction, these are the kind of like steps we need to take.
How cooperative are all the preprint server people running the preprint servers in terms of sharing these kind of things? Because I kind of imagine you all have a big club you get together at every now and then.
I wish.
That's based on you, John, and Richard, because you're the only ones I've spoken to, and you're all really nice people.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's probably not entirely true.
No, it's, you know, we do have touch points with each other through various working groups and initiatives. A lot of it, ASAP Bio just does a great job kind of uniting the preprint leaders. And we do have some spaces in which we can share information and talk, but it's not happening as much as I would like. I'd like it to happen. And I, you know, part of that is just the complexities of each of these servers. You know, ours is has a majority investment from a major publisher. Yeah, that's, you know, that complicates things. So does SSRN. So does Authoria, you know. But that doesn't stop me from, like, I can sort of, I don't have to get too caught up in that point in order to focus on the matter at hand. And to me, you know, having these integrations with the journals has been hugely impactful for preprints, because it means that there's just this exposure of this mechanism of sharing your work early to a whole group of people who wouldn't otherwise know about it or know that it was an acceptable practice that was actually endorsed by the very journal that you're submitting to right now, right? And that was a huge show of support on the part of the publishers that have taken on these preprint servers. And so I have good relationships with people who have sort of analogous roles to me at Elsevier, at SSRN, and other servers. And we talk about we share information mostly about screening and, you know, what these kinds of things, right? Like, what do you do when paper's retracted, or how do you guys go about finding this stuff? I want them to be successful there too. because when we're, you know, when they're successful, it reflects better on the entire enterprise of preprinting. It doesn't matter where that, you know, the mechanism is actually originating, in my opinion. You know, if we're all doing it responsibly, then you know, the whole thing will look better, or the whole project will look better, right? So that's my philosophy. I don't know if it's shared across the board, but yeah, that's the way I look at it.
We all want a better system, and I don't think it really matters what that system is as long as it's better. I mean, I push preprints a lot, but they're not necessarily an answer. Something else might be. Whatever is the answer is that's what we should all hopefully be striving towards. Right. Maybe it all get better. Maybe one of the side effects of Elsevier buying absolutely everything to do with the research and academic ecosystem will be that actually all the tools are all there. We no longer have to submit to multiple different editorial managers because Elsevier owns the one, and we all use the one.
Owns all of them.
You know, do an Apple on us for a while.
Generally, that doesn't that doesn't bear out. Having one person, one organization, be in control of everything.
No.
But yeah,
we can be hopeful.
But I'm personally, you know, a huge fan of the diversity. It's a problem because it creates complexity, and everybody has different budgets and different governance and different policies and different operations, and so that creates some confusion and lack of consistency in the scholarly record as a result. But I love that these preprint servers are cropping up for different, you know, for small communities that are you know, dedicated to particular disciplines or particular countries that have historically not been have kind of historically been excluded from all of this. So that's just a, you know, mostly a positive thing here. It's just that, and that's exactly why I appreciate the ASAP Bio organization so much, because they're really kind of making that effort to include everybody and pull everybody together to have the same conversation so we can all benefit from each other's experience and perhaps come to some agreement on some best practices. And that, you know, there's a lot of outputs now from working groups that have had exactly those goals in mind.
Yeah, we were saying the other week that everything ASAP Bio does is just, it's an incredible effort, because it's I think it's hugely unappreciated outside of sort of our circles, but it is it's just insane the amount of impact that something relatively simple when you're on the face of it has kind of had.
Yes, totally.
That's all my questions. I'm out of questions.
That's perfect.
And I still haven't figured out how to end the show properly yet, a year in. But I did say it would be nice and easy, so there you go.
You should do what the other podcasters do and ask about, you know, a favorite book. But no, don't do that, because I... favorite paper, favorite recent controversial preprint.
My PI loves art, and he always tries to bond with me by talking about art. And I've just gotten not along because I've got no idea what he's on about. It would be like that. If I asked anything remotely book-related, I just have to nod along and pretend I know them all. I'd come across incredibly uncultured, so we're not going to do that.
So something you are familiar with. You
have not
to,
a lot.
You have to find something. Music.
90s pop.
There you go. Hey, that would be great, just to end everyone. And what's your favorite 90s pop band?
Okay, and that is the show. If you enjoyed listening, then hit that subscribe button for more and leave us a review on whatever platform it is you're listening on. You can reach out to us on Twitter at MotionPod or online at preprintsinmotion.com. Didn't enjoy that? Well, we're all scientists here, so send us your review and let us know what works or what you'd like to hear more of, or less of. But until next time, have a good week.
Where do I find out about the different bioarchive licenses? This CC, BY, CDXY nonsense is driving me nuts.
ASAP Bio have a resource for that.
Ugh, that's your answer to everything.
That's because they have everything you need to know about preprints.
Sure, they probably have the basics, like info on the preprint servers, but what else is there?
There's so much more. Looking to post a preprint, but not sure what different journal policies are? They have a collection to help you out with that. There are meetings around preprints and associated services. If you want to know how preprint adoption has changed over time, there's even a page on that.
And COVID?
They have a big section on preprints and the pandemic, plus some really cool infographics for communicating preprints.
And university policies? Surely they don't have that.
They collect uni policies where possible.
Okay, they do sound pretty impressive, but is it not a bit of an echo chamber?
It can be, but ASAP Bio also engage with people who don't love preprints. and have concerns. So we had an excellent discussion on this very topic a couple of months ago.
Oh, is there anything ASAP Bio don't do?
Honestly, no. They're so nice over there. They were so quick to jump in and support this show. It's your one-stop shop for info on preprints and open science initiatives. So head over to asapbio.org to learn more and subscribe to their newsletter for the latest in preprint news. If you want a deeper dive into the world of preprints, then look out for the next recruitment of ASAP Bio Fellows.